It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace is set up by the Affordable Care Act. Starts on November 1st. That's Thursday of this week. We want to catch up on how the Affordable Care Act, the insurance marketplace is set up by it, and other aspects of it have been changed and are continuing to change. Pete Damiano is with us, director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Welcome back to our studio. In the past, we had you on quite a bit through 2009, all the way through the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Now we're seeing some changes. Let's go through those changes as you see them. But first, I want to reach out to our listeners. And if the ACA impacts your health coverage, and tell us what you're experiencing and what questions you may have. This half hour with Pete Damiano, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Pete, in our news, we've heard about notable attempts to repeal Obamacare,
right,
the ACA, over the last year and a half. That repeal hasn't gone through fully, but the ACA has been undergoing change. What's been happening?
Right. So while it does, the major reform, as you're talking about, or repeal, did not happen, there have been a number of changes. And when we talk about Obamacare, and for the most part, what we're really talking about is what's called the individual or small business insurance market. So those are people who don't get insurance through their employer, are going to be going down to a Walmart office or a Farm Bureau office or, you know, somewhere like that to get insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And those are also the people that have been going to healthcare.gov and getting subsidized health insurance in the past. We've all heard about in the last couple of years that the number of products available on Iowa's health insurance marketplace has declined. Last year, it was just Medica. The prices went up in part because they were only one carrier, in part because of some other federal changes that we'll talk about here in just a moment. And now this year, with the open enrollment period, people are going to have two choices of Medica and Wellmark. All of that is sort of under this umbrella almost or cloud of the elimination of the individual mandate, which is not for this year, but it's going to start for 2019. So that was a major federal change. So as you mentioned, there was no overall repeal, but there are a number of little nicks and cuts to it that we don't know yet what the implications are going to be for this individual insurance market.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the big one. It's been estimated that that could mean a loss of coverage of between 3 to 13 million people nationally, and how it's going to impact costs. Costs could go up as a result of that because of changes in who's left, that it's going to be only the really sick people who are going to then have to get it, and people, if they feel like they're healthy, they won't. But there's also been some other little changes that we don't know what it's going to mean. So last year, they shortened the enrollment period. So now it's only a month and a half instead of 3 months. So that's a November 1st to December 15th. They also cut the advertising and marketing budget. And basically, it's advertising in the sense that it's communication. You know, it's so that people really understand what's there.
And they
what's
can reach out
it.
For help if they need it.
And they can reach out to help. There are people mm-hmm. there, but they cut that budget by 90%. They eliminated what are called these cost-sharing reduction payments to insurance companies and these risk adjustment payments that weren't government costs. These were actually being pooled from insurance companies that were doing well to insurance companies that happen to have higher risk because they took on some sicker people. And so those were eliminated, which is part of the reason costs went up a lot last year. They seem to have stabilized in at least what they're talking about. We don't know what the prices are yet because the enrollment period hasn't happened. And the one some of your listeners might have heard about last week was another announcement of something called these 1332 innovation waivers that would basically allow people to get subsidized insurance on the marketplace, even if their plans aren't what's called ACA compliant, meaning that they cover all of the services and benefits that they're supposed to.
These are skimpier plans. What is meant by
Correct.
That?
So skimpier is in the eye of the beholder, right? It depends. Ultimately, you would like to only be able to pay for what you think you're going to need, but obviously insurance generally doesn't do that. And in healthcare in particular, we don't know at the beginning of the year what our healthcare costs are going to be. We'd like to think that they're nothing but prevention, unless we have a chronic health condition or pre-existing condition of some sort. We know we're going to need it. And that gets into, you know, what people's concerned with a lot of these changes and what it's going to mean. But yes, there's a couple of ways that these skimpy plans are going to now be in play. So one of them, if a state were to do this innovation waiver, but that hasn't happened anywhere yet. But what is happening, like in Iowa, the legislature passed the ability for, and this is going to be primarily Farm Bureau, to offer Wellmark plans that are not ACA compliant, and they're not considered health insurance. So they're going to be a different type of a product.
They can't be called health insurance.
They can't be called health insurance, and they're not regulated by the health insurance commissioner. And so it's going to be a little bit of a, we'll kind of have to see. You know, you don't, for some people, it might be okay. For other people, it may not. This is where some of the concern about pre-existing conditions. If you come in and you're sicker, they don't have to price it in such a way where it's going to be more affordable like you'd had to under the Affordable Care Act. There's some other things that I don't necessarily want to get to, but there's these things called MEWAs and that are, they're multiple employer welfare arrangements where they can sort of pool together. We've had them in the past. They didn't work. They were fraught with fraud issues, but trying them again. The association health plans. And now the other big thing is these short-term health plans. So it used to be you could get a non-compliant health plan for 3 months. Then it was a year. Now they're going to say it's renewable for up to 3 years. So it's going to be less than a year, but renewable for 3 years. The big problem with all of this is that our individual insurance market just isn't that big. So in Iowa this past year was about 107,000. And you're starting to tease away that fabric and all those little threads so that do you have enough people left in any of these pots that the risk pool can work for an insurance company without some sort of a subsidy? And again, this was a way of keeping private insurance companies in the game, not doing a government takeover, not, as some people would call it, not doing a national health insurance.
So what is your answer to that question? Is it going to be teased apart so much that the insurance is just not viable?
Well, it's very difficult right now. And that was one of the reasons we only had one plan last year. And while Wellmark has sort of jumped in and out because it isn't clear if it's even viable without these things. I think this is one of those wait and sees that we'll see how it works for this coming year, but can make it very confusing for the consumers.
Okay. If you've just joined us, Pete Damiano is with us, director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. He tries to help us make sense of what's happening in our health care system with health insurance. If you'd like to join us, 1-866-780-9100. Your experience with the ACA insurance marketplaces, open enrollment for those insurance marketplaces set up by the ACA starts November 1st. Before we do get some input from listeners, speak to Medicaid expansion. That was part of the ACA. Medicaid, a joint federal and state program that helps with medical costs for some people with limited income and resources. Of course, hundreds of thousands in Iowa who are Medicaid recipients.
Right. And so Iowa did do the Medicaid expansion under what's called the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan. Now it's the Iowa Wellness Plan, or HealthLink is another term for it. And that's basically the whole Medicaid program. But the expansion part was primarily single adults from 0 to 100% of poverty who were not eligible for Medicaid before. Many of these people are working at low-wage jobs or have a disability that didn't allow them to be qualified for Medicaid previously or something like that. So in Iowa, other than the whole issue of the Medicaid managed care, which this isn't really related to, but if you are low income, there is an option for health insurance coverage. What's interesting nationally is these states that have not participated to this point.
In the expansion.
It's been primarily very political, red, blue. Blue states have tended to do it, not entirely. Red states have tended not, but there have been more red states that are looking at, we're leaving all this federal money on the table. We should think about it. And there's four state referendums coming up next week in Idaho, Montana, Nebraska, and Utah to all see about signing up for the Medicaid expansion as a state.
Okay, let's go to a listener, 1-866-780-9100. Jackie is with us. Jackie lives in Marion. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
I understand you have been involved in getting insurance through the ACA health insurance marketplaces?
Yeah. I work as a consultant, so I don't get health insurance through my employer. So I've been buying on the marketplace for the last couple of years.
Right. And I understand you have a sort of a workaround that you found, but tell us about the choices you faced for health insurance before you found the workaround, which you'll describe in a minute.
Oh, man. Yeah, like you were saying, this last year, there was only one option, the Medica option. And the lowest price plan was $550. And since I didn't qualify for any subsidies, that was a lot of money every month.
$550 a month,
Yeah.
So you bought that insurance?
Yeah, I had to. I have some kind of extreme hobbies. I do partner acrobatics. So I'm 33. I'm pretty healthy, but I have a very high risk of getting severely injured because of the hobbies that I do. So I had to get health insurance.
Mm-hmm. You found a different approach to getting affordable, quality health insurance. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was talking to a bunch of people, telling them, I can't afford this, but this is all that's available. So someone mentioned that the university actually has student health insurance. And I was really surprised to hear that was something that was an option. And I guess you really only have to take one semester long class in order to get it. And it's really good health insurance because it's the university. So I enrolled in a class so that I could get health insurance.
Mm-hmm. When did you start doing this?
Just this last semester. Mm-hmm. So I managed to get in for the fall semester.
So what you said, it's better insurance than you would have had otherwise with the insurance marketplace?
Oh, yeah, it's way better. I was having so much trouble getting any doctors to be able to take me in the first place because so many don't accept Medica. Like the university hospital itself doesn't accept Medica. So
in your case?
No, in anybody's case. Medica isn't covered through the university hospital.
Pete, weigh in on that because there might be a question about that.
Well, I think the provider network issue is something that's very challenging, I think, with consumers and trying to figure out where they can and can't go. And even within the same system, there might be certain facilities or certain places or there's certain things that they can go to or not. Mm-hmm. And so it's a tough call when you're trying to figure out what to purchase in advance.
But the long and short of it is Jackie, you're much more you have much better insurance now. And how much do you pay compared to what you had paid before through Medica?
I had to pay for the class, so it was $1,000 for the semester, but it's only $200 a month, I believe. So it's less than half of what I was paying before.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you want to continue to do.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you know of others who are doing the same thing. Obviously, you heard about it from someone else who's doing it.
Yeah, I heard about it from a massage therapist who said that she had a bunch of older clients, actually, who were doing that, too.
Okay. Jackie, thank you very much. A consultant and entrepreneur lives in Marion, found an interesting workaround there. Jackie, take care.
Thank you.
Pete, yeah, comment on that. That's interesting, someone figuring out the environment and now happy with the workaround. That's not the way the system was intended. But.
No, it wasn't. In fact, one of the things that I was very excited about the potential for with the marketplace availability was for people who felt like they were locked in their current employment situation to now be able to buy reasonably priced insurance and subsidized, so that they could change to do something they really wanted to do. And what it might do to entrepreneurialism and quality of life and a lot of those different kinds of things. But because we haven't figured out exactly this individual insurance market, and we still have 10.5% of the population that's uninsured who haven't, if you put all of them into the individual market who are eligible for it, then you might actually have something that might be viable. So some of the what I think are some of the more interesting benefits of doing it, in addition to just covering people who, need the care, I'm not sure is happening. And this is an example where it didn't directly, but she was creative enough to find a way to make it work.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you talk about all these changes, Pete. I don't know if this is a fair characterization of where this is headed or what we have. Is what's happening to our insurance marketplace? Are we transforming to sort of a back to the future type of thing when before this 2010 federal law took effect that regulation coverage, consumer protections are now in a patchwork across the country? And it varies widely depending on the state that you're in.
Right. And it always has because insurance is regulated at the state level. And that's what makes it very difficult for the argument that we should just sell insurance across state lines and everything would be fine. Well, it doesn't work that way. And the few experiments that have been tried, it hasn't. Not saying there might be some ways that it could work, but it's much, much more difficult than people might think. And using it as a way to drive down the price to something that's really affordable is challenging. But this patchwork is a big problem. And we went before the ACA where the advantages, you could say, were lean toward the insurance companies and that they could, you know, with pre-existing condition, charge differently and have annual maximums and lifetime maximums, drop people when they got insurance. The ACA said, you can't do that anymore. But that did change the pricing. And then some of the insurance companies just said, hey, we don't want to play. And so now we're trying to slide back, as you're sort of saying, back to the future with some of the pre-existing condition may be charged more and some of these other protections that were put in.
Interesting. Five more minutes with Pete Damiano of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Let's get a quick call in from Mike in Des Moines. You've been listening, Mike. What's on your mind in this context?
I wonder if you could comment on the innovation that I think six or seven states have put in place to create a reinsurance fund. I think Minnesota has one. Wisconsin, I know, has just been approved for one. And I think numerous, both Democrats and Republican governors have created these. And it's had the effect, as I understand it, of reducing rates in the ACA market on average by about 20%. Are you familiar with that? And do you think that might work in Iowa?
Reinsurance from Mike in Des Moines.
Yes. In fact, Iowa had what's called this 1332 waiver proposal that they put in a little bit ago and was turned down by the Trump administration. And a key component of that was a reinsurance program. The state proposal was basically going to try to take a lot of the funds that were currently available and reuse them in different ways.
That is what reinsurance is?
Well, the idea of the reinsurance is that there'd be a pool of funds so that if an insurance company has the $1 million a month person like Wellmark had talked about last year and said, you know, we can't do this, that there would be a pool of money to help with those outliers. And that was something that was supposed to be in the ACA, actually was for about the first 3 years. Was discontinued by the Republicans in the Congress as part of this kind of knick-knick approach, of, you know, getting at the Affordable Care Act. And sure, could it be? What people would have to be comfortable with is providing more subsidies, if you will, to insurance companies. And that was something that Senator Rubio campaigned against when he ran for president in 2016 and said it was, you know, a government subsidy to corporations. You know, you can't have it both ways. This pool, because it's so small, work great? No. Could reinsurance be a part of that answer? Yes. But we have to be comfortable with that's what we want to do as a policy.
Pete, I believe you coined a phrase here. I'd like to have you explain accidentally insured people. Who are they?
Right. The accidentally uninsured.
Uninsured, sorry.
So when the ACA was first put in place, the idea was that everyone would have some option for coverage. Mm-hmm. Those lower-income folks under 100% of poverty would be eligible for the Medicaid expansion. And then from 100 to 400%, they would be eligible for a subsidy of private insurance. So it was this public-private partnership idea. Everybody would have something. When the Supreme Court ruled that the Medicaid expansion was no longer something that the feds could require of the states, you pulled that part of that fabric apart and said that if you're right now, like in Texas or Florida, and you're at 99% of poverty, you have no option for insurance coverage. But if you're at 101% of poverty, you can basically get almost free private insurance. And so that's left millions of people uninsured and is leaving literally billions of dollars on the table by some of these states. I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing some of these states that had declined it before. There's 17 of them that are doing it. And I think there's also this political effect of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under the Trump administration has said you can think about a work requirement. That gives a little cover to the red states to say, you know, hey, we're going to make these people work, even though there have been studies that show it's a really small proportion.
To make it politically viable.
But it will provide coverage for a lot of people.
Interesting.
Who have no other option.
Got a couple more minutes with Pete Damiano. Let's go to Joe. Joe, in Ryan, are you in a town called Ryan?
Yes, I'm in the combine cab right now, so I hope.
You are. Yes, we can hear you, Joe. Out on the farm. We don't have much time. You'll have to make it quick, but we're sure glad to have you on.
I had my insurance through Wellmark, and I was dropped, so I was forced to go to the ACA. And unfortunately, in my position, I can't have no insurance. And in order to get back into Wellmark, we're actually incorporating the farm so that we can get small group status. Because if a business produces at least two W-2s a year, they can get that small group status to get back into Wellmark if they don't want to be on the ACA.
Right. So are you happy about the way the health coverage looks for you doing that, making that move?
No, because I have a pre-existing condition. So,
will that be covered, do you think?
Hopefully. But unfortunately, in today's atmosphere, there's really not a lot of options. So I guess you do what you can.
Right. Joe, thank you. Keep safe there on the combine and have a pleasant day. So there's a lot of, and you heard it in Joe, there's just a lot of uncertainty about what's going to be happening in the future. We have an election next week. How much does control of either house in Congress have to do with the future of our health care? I'm not sure.
Right. And again, just to bring it back, we're talking about the individual insurance market in particular.
Right.
And are these little or big things like the individual mandate getting riveted, are they really going to undermine the individual insurance market to make it difficult and having all of these multiple types of products so that you're teasing that apart when we've got a relatively small risk pool? Are they going to be problematic? Yes. Is there a simple answer to that? No, there really isn't on this individual insurance side. And I think we're going to have to decide, you know, do we want to do the reinsurance so that we could have more insurance companies that would come in? Do we want to mandate prices in a way that we haven't? Because the insurance companies aren't being told what prices they can come in. They have to go in front of the insurance commissioner and verify their cost increases and things like that. But there's a lot of this uncertainty that's part of why we're just talking about it. It's going to be really tough this year in particular, probably more than any for a while, because of these new products that are coming out, some regulated, some not, and what the pricing is going to be in this open enrollment period.
Okay. Pete Damiano, sir, glad to have you with us, surveying, making some sense of this terrain that is changing quickly, an uncertain future. But thank you for telling us a little bit about the fate of the Affordable Care Act insurance marketplaces. We'll look forward to having you back. Thanks, Pete.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll have two guests address the violence of recent days in Pittsburgh and Kentucky, also those bomb threats. I'll talk with Rabbi David Kaufman in Des Moines, also with the University of Iowa religious scholar Bob Cargill. We'll talk about the rise of anti-Semitism here in the United States. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the violence of the past week, that horrible mass killing at the Pittsburgh synagogue, the shooting in Kentucky, the recent wave of explosive devices sent to prominent Democrats, all of it is reverberating through our communities, sparking conversations about the national atmosphere of division, fear, and even hatred. I'm joined now by Rabbi David Kaufman of Temple B'nai Jeshurun in Des Moines. Rabbi, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
You've called for Americans to hold each other accountable for hate in the wake of Saturday's mass shooting. Hold each other accountable. What does that mean?
Well, it means that when you hear somebody who is offering words of hate or thoughts of hate, it's important to speak out about it. And that's true not just when they're your political opponents, which is really easy to do. It's always easy to offer criticism of people you don't like and aren't close to. It's very difficult at times to offer criticism of our friends. What we need to do here is there are a lot of times where the problem is that our friends are sharing this stuff. They're sharing it on Facebook. They're sharing it on Twitter. They're talking about it in discussions around the dinner table. And it's important for us to make sure that we're speaking out about those things and telling people that it's not okay, because if we're allowing our friends to do it, it's much more difficult for us to discourage anybody else to do it.
Mm-hmm. Have you, Rabbi, discouraged people yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I end up speaking out pretty much all the time. If you follow me on Facebook or you come to services and hear me speak, I tend to criticize both sides fairly regularly. And, you know, it's not something that makes people happy all the time. But, you know, I found in this environment it's becoming increasingly difficult for me to sit idly by and be quiet. So mm-hmm. I tend to speak out more, I think, than most people do. Partly also because I communicate with both sides of the political spectrum, and I communicate from the middle. So it's very often I don't make people on either side happy.
Right. What qualifies for you as hate speech? It's not always clear, is it?
No. So part of the problem is that there are issues that come up that it's important to talk about. You know, we have differences in religion, right? So we have different things about what we believe. We have different histories. But the issue is, you know, you can share your differences in belief and faith without saying nasty things about the people who don't agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are pretty significant lines that I think people regularly cross. And I won't say in the old days it didn't happen, because in the old days it happened worse. You know, there were religious wars over a lot of these differences. There were genocides and massive persecution. You know, if you go back a few hundred years, attacks on religious institutions were far from few and in between, right? I mean, they were fairly regular. And I think that it's important to understand that part of what this country was founded on was tolerance and opposition to religious bigotry. And the idea that people were able to practice their faith in security. There are documents from the origin of this country that are about that. The letter that Moses Satius, who was the president of the Newport, Rhode Island Synagogue, wrote to George Washington was talking about, was asking basically whether or not this country was one that would give the persecution no assistance. And bigotry no sanction. And George Washington responded, absolutely, you know, and repeating the words. This is what this country was about, what we were founded on. And this idea that we've now moved away from that, that we're now intolerant on both sides, really. I mean, this really is an issue where there's intolerance on both sides.
Right.
Religious right is very intolerant of the religious left. The religious left is very intolerant of the religious right. And both sides tend to feel free to share hatred of the other side.
Yeah, Rabbi Kaufman, you mentioned not quoting the words, but referring to a letter, an exchange between George Washington and a rabbi back in the late 1700s. Our first president there, you're quoting, give us a sense of the way you see, perhaps the Jewish community in Des Moines sees, Donald Trump's leadership at this moment on this question?
Well, I mean, I think for me, the president has not spoken up enough, at least up until recently, in opposition to things said by people who say that they're his supporters. And I don't know that it's fair to say that he necessarily supports those views, but I think it is fair to say that he hasn't spoken up clearly enough until recently. Some of the statements that he said recently have been very declarative, very unequivocal in opposition to the hatred. I think that the turn in recent times has been much better in regard to that specifically.
Let me ask you about what the Anti-Defamation League calls the Tree of Life Synagogue killings, the single deadliest attack on American Jewry. Group has sounded this alarm for months, the Anti-Defamation League, and what it sees as a historic rise in anti-Semitic incidents from 2016 to 2017. They say the biggest single-year increase in reported anti-Jewish hate since they started tracking that data almost 40 years ago. Here in Iowa, also a spike tracked in anti-Semitic incidents reported in 2017 in its annual audit. The Anti-Defamation League said Iowa saw an increase from no incidents of anti-Semitism in 2016 to 9 incidents in 2017. Rabbi, what do you think is behind this spike?
Well, a couple things. One, I think awareness is, and I think an interest and willingness in reporting is. So some of that is that most of the time, Jews ignore this stuff. They don't even tell their family members, much less their rabbi, much less other organizations about things. There are long periods of time where we would see swastikas or you'd hear statements, and we simply wouldn't report them because it wasn't worthwhile. People would brush it off. They wouldn't care. I think one of the things that's happened lately is that there's more concern and there's more care shown. So people are more willing to speak out about it, what they see, and there's more concern shown for the different reports. So that's I think, a good thing. I think the bad thing is also that the people who have these views have become more brazen in their willingness to share them and their willingness to go out and to try to act out. I mean, just in the last week alone, we had two people who share radical views who are willing to one send bombs and another one go to the synagogue and shoot people. And both of them, I'm sure, felt very justified in what they were doing, right? These were not people who were wondering whether or not what they had done was correct. And I think we've done, because of the political polarization of our environment right now, I think that a lot of people believe that when they hear criticism of their views, that they can just disregard it entirely. Because of that, people aren't listening to voices that would discourage radical behavior. And so they start, they feel justified in doing it and then do it.
Mm-hmm.
That leads to a rise in hate crimes of all sorts. And I think that anytime you have hatred against minorities of any kind, anytime you're dealing with problems with immigration, with concern about immigration from the political right, anytime you're dealing with things related to Israel on the left, you're going to end up with an increase in anti-Semitic action. And we've kind of had both of them over the last few years.
Right. We're running short of time, Rabbi, but I wanted to ask you about specifically about your community there in Des Moines. Do you as a community, a Jewish community in Des Moines, feel safe? Have you increased security?
Well, we increased security a while ago already, and certainly paying attention to what's going on in the community. There are plans to increase security still further and to make sure that we're securing what we're doing. But as far as, an overall community, one thing I would say is you can never really plan against single individuals. A single individual can always do things. And that's one of the things we just have to deal with in life is stopping single individuals from acting is extraordinarily difficult. And unfortunately, they're going to find opportunities to succeed. But on the whole, the reality is we feel very supported in Des Moines. We feel very secure in Des Moines, probably as secure as any community in the country. And the outpouring of love and support and concern that was shown last night at the vigil for the Pittsburgh synagogue was beautiful. Mm-hmm. People from across the political spectrum, from across the religious spectrum, numerous people from the Muslim community, including a number of imams, reached out. It's been really, really wonderful.
Well,
very much appreciated.
Thank you, Rabbi David Kaufman of Temple B'nai Jeshurun in Des Moines. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Rabbi.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the wake of the killings at the Pittsburgh synagogue, let's talk more about the roots of anti-Semitism here in the United States with Bob Cargill. He's Associate Professor of Judaism and Christianity at the University of Iowa, a religious scholar. Welcome to our studio, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
I want to mention that you're having an event. The Department of History is presenting an event, panel discussion, I guess, Understanding Anti-Semitism. Tell us about it and who's involved.
This is at 5 o'clock on Thursday on campus at the University of Iowa. This will be Professor Heinemann from the Department of History and Rabbi Esther Hugenholtz from Agudas Akim from the synagogue here in Coralville. And this was a panel that we put together on very short notice to discuss for the students and for anybody in the public who wants to come, basically what happened at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, and not only what happened there, but why this is happening. Why are we seeing this?
Right. Talk specifically about what caused this alleged shooter to do this, his anti-Semitic motivation, as far as you can understand from the reports and your scholarly work in this area.
Sure. Well, it's the first thing I like to point out to my students is anti-Semitism includes anti-Jewish and anti-Arab peoples, right? I always remind my students that Arabs are also Semitic. So we tend to say anti-Semitism and group that as with anti-Jewish behavior, but that's also anti-Arab behavior. Mm-hmm. So this was an anti-Jewish murder. This was an anti-Jewish killing. And so this man on his social profile, his social media profile, his Gab profile, which has since been taken down, had a verse from the Bible, John 8:44, which says that the Jews are the children of Satan. And this has long been everybody's known about this verse in the Bible for a long time, but he reads it very literally. And since Satan must be destroyed, since he's evil, then Jews must be destroyed. And this is a horrible misinterpretation, misreading. Most Christians aren't anti-Semitic. Most Christians don't read the Bible in this way. But this individual did this, and unfortunately, throughout history, over the past 2,000 years, some Christians have read the Bible this way, and he wanted to kill Jews. He thought that they were the equivalent of Satan, and he took matters into his own hands and tried to kill as many Jews as he could.
Mm-hmm. Put this in the context of anti-Semitism in the U.S., in our history.
Contrary to popular myth, we were not founded as a Christian nation. We took many measures to try to make sure that that there was this separation, that we were founded as a secular nation. That said, I always say that we weren't founded as a Christian nation, but we were founded by many Christians. There were many Christians in this country early on. Those Christian beliefs influenced this nation. They influenced Europe and they influenced nation. They influence what we call Western society. And so because Christianity predominantly drove society, our laws, our morals, because Christianity drove that, these verses, John 8 and some of the other verses that have been flagged as what we call anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish verses, mm-hmm. have always been there, underlying, and they've been carried through Europe and into the early Americas. So when we look at Ulysses S. Grant issuing General Order Number 11, which basically expelled Jews from areas under his control in western Tennessee, and fortunately that was immediately overturned by Abraham Lincoln. When we look at what Henry Ford did, who held Jews responsible for World War I.
What do you make of the spike in anti-Semitic incidents in Iowa, also across the country, the Anti-Defamation League tracking these in Iowa, seeing an increase from no incidents in 2016 to 9 in 2017, much greater increases in other states, in California. I know you're recently a resident of California. Mm-hmm. What's causing these spikes?
I don't know. I mean, the answer is, you know, it's hard to point at one thing. Certainly a lot of people are pointing at the increased polemic, the rhetoric within our political discourse that for whatever reason we want to blame, it is now okay to demonize the other side, both sides. You know, you hear this, both sides are to blame. Well, we can debate that. But for some reason now, it's okay to demonize your political opponent with language that used to be reserved for, you know, someone that you were at war with. And now it's just the political opposition, and we're demonizing them. And when you do that, when it's okay to demonize someone with whom you disagree politically, now all of a sudden, everything's on the table. And simple verses, remember this John 8 verse where Jesus is having a dispute with his religious interpretive opponents about how to interpret scripture, you know, they're calling each other names. Jesus is saying his political opponents are children of the devil, and they're saying he's demon-possessed. And now this has become licensed to kill Jews. It's a gross misinterpretation. Anti-Defamation League says there's been a 57% increase in 2017 alone in anti-Semitic attacks, the largest single-year increase since they started tracking this in 1979. It's getting out of control. And unfortunately, I don't think we're done seeing attacks like this.
Let me have you comment on the president's leadership. Some Jewish leaders have written a letter following the mass shooting on Saturday that they do not want the president to visit Pittsburgh until he denounces white nationalism. But on the other hand, Donald Trump is a strong backer of Israel. His daughter and son-in-law are Jewish. Is the Jewish community split here? What do you make of the president's leadership at this time?
You need to remember that this murderer who murdered these worshipers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the only reason that he didn't like Donald Trump is he thought that he was a sellout. He thought that he let too many Jews into his administration. If you read his social profile, the reason that he didn't support Trump was he had too many Jews in his son-in-law was Jewish. His daughter converted to Judaism. That tells you something, the idea that he would have liked Trump, but he had too many Jews around him. We also need to get rid of this notion that if you're pro-Israel, that is, if you're pro-Israeli government, mm-hmm. and the government's policies, that means you know and appreciate and understand the plight of the Jewish people and Jewish worshipers. Keep in mind that a majority, because it's a parliamentary system in Israel, the majority of Israelis, right, of Jews in Israel, didn't vote for the Israeli government, for Netanyahu and the government there. So over there, because it's a parliamentary system, you just need a plurality, right? So most Israelis don't support the Israeli government and the decisions that they're making. So it's one thing to say, yay, Israel, I'm pro, you know, Israel government. That doesn't mean that you know and understand the plight of the Jewish people here or abroad. It certainly doesn't mean that the Israelis support the Israeli government.
Mm-hmm. A few minutes ago, I spoke with Rabbi David Kaufman of Des Moines, the temple there. He's said that he's telling his community to hold each other accountable, hold friends accountable. I'm wondering if you subscribe to that, or what you would tell individuals to do, and when to do what.
I think it is incumbent upon especially non-Jews. Now, I am not Jewish. But I think that non-Jews, especially Christians, need to do more than to stand idly by and hold the coats of those who are doing this polemic, this rhetoric, and watching these attacks take place.
So saying nothing,
nothing, and just saying, you know, I don't want to be political. I just want to be neutral. I want to be diplomatic. That's not enough. To do nothing is to take a stand. And what you're doing is you're empowering the people who are doing that. If you do nothing, if you say nothing, what you're basically saying is those people who are shooting up synagogues, those people are using this hatred and this polemic, that's okay. Mm-hmm. You have to stand up. As uncomfortable as it makes you feel, you have to take a stand.
Bob Cargill, Associate Professor of Judaism and Christianity at the University of Iowa, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.